Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. A pleasure to have you with us here on Close Up Radio Live, a service of the Telly Award-winning Close Up Television and Radio. We're very excited to welcome from Southboro, Massachusetts, pain management specialist, Dr. Thomas Simpelis. Now, anesthesiologists are often faced with patients suffering from severe or significant pain following surgery. As a result, they possess the most comprehensive understanding of the neuroanatomy of pain pathways in the body, with the most experience using medications and nerve blocks to treat pain. That's why anesthesiology and pain management go hand in hand. But with Dr. Thomas, as an anesthesiology and pain management specialist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, his work as a pain management specialist is also as an expert witness, offering litigation support services to attorneys of both plaintiffs and defendants for some 15 years. Expert witness work is what found him rather than he finding it. What he likes about the expert witness work is that, you know, you just have to stay within the facts and the evidence. So while most of the cases are standard chart reviews, there are cases that require the doctor to perform his own medical examination. These kinds of cases are typically complex nerve injury cases that may develop into chronic pain syndrome that at times may be diagnosed correctly or incorrectly, or difficult to treat or resolve. He says in the legal system, nerve injury-related pains and chronic pains are tough to define. This creates a lot of challenges in the system. He comes in as an expert witness to shed some light and create a direction. Sometimes we reach maximum medical improvement, he says, and that might not be satisfactory for the patient or the employer, but some patients never improve adequately with their chronic pain condition. Fascinating conversation. Welcoming the doctor to the show for the first time here exclusively on Close Up Radio for this 30-minute conversation. Doctor, welcome to Close Up Radio. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, and you're very, very welcome. I'd love to discuss this relationship between anesthesiology and pain management, because the two disciplines, they seem to go hand in hand, and the vast majority of pain management specialists, I would imagine, are anesthesiologists, right?
Yes, I that's exactly correct. I think that the fact that we deal with a lot of pain immediately after operations or even after trauma that we see very commonly at the hospital, we see that a lot of these patients have a protracted course. Some go on to have chronic pain, and that they needed long-term care. This allowed or paved the road for many of us to branch into chronic pain and establish chronic pain care clinics that are now our common care, and other specialties such as neurology, rehabilitation medicine, psychiatry, psychology, physical therapy have all participated in the care of these patients.
It's fascinating work. It really, really is on so many different levels. When a patient experiences chronic pain and they go to a physician that cannot or does not or will not help them, in their desperation, I guess they start looking for alternative methods that aren't as effective, maybe over-the-counter things or just whatever it is, to really numb it, but it doesn't necessarily treat what's going on. The cause. They treat more the symptom and they try to do it themselves.
Yes, because that's exactly right. Because it is not very commonly taught the mechanisms or causes of chronic pain or the acknowledgement of chronic pain in medical school even today, many physicians that enter into practice are kind of left in the dark about this, and so may dismiss these complaints that patients commonly have. So patients are left to do their own research online, then, as you just stated, resort to over-the-counter therapies, alternative treatments. We know that many patients seek out alternative treatments such as massage, acupuncture, are great examples, and then even marijuana products that we see that's been scaling up quite a bit because of the lack of satisfactory results from traditional medicine.
Mm. So, yeah, that can really mount into ongoing issues on many different levels. How were you introduced to the expert witness work, and how did that come about for you, Doctor? I mean, in addition to all the other stuff that you're doing as a pain management specialist, you know, you've added that in, which is incredible work.
I think that's a great question. I think the first thing that happens in these arenas is some of the things that you said. In this space, there's a lot of ambiguity at times about chronic pain because it's not kind of mainstream. So what happens to patients is they're left with a lot of unanswered questions, and so is the general public for that fact. So they're not familiar with chronic nerve pain or pain that may persist after trauma, after surgery, and often these patients are not well cared for in the system, leading to employment issues, leading to litigation issues. Often diagnoses are thrown at these patients, not with a very meticulous exam or evaluation of the patients. This leads to many questions as to their actual diagnosis, prognosis, appropriate care, that then enters the legal system. And I think that just locally, attorneys look for people who are specialists in this area, been practicing a while, and have built a known reputation. And that's how I've kind of entered it. People found me in the litigation system or the legal system, and then it kind of grew from there.
Then it expanded from there. Really, again, it ties in neatly with the expertise that you have. It would make sense that you would be, you know, or take on this role because of the expertise and the background. Of course, I imagine the whole point of the expert witness is to bring this focus and this clarity. But I guess could that sometimes be tough or tricky only because pain is so ambiguous? Pain does what it wants to do when it wants to do it, and we're always trying to dig in to try to find out what's causing it. How do you sort of be that link between those two realms, that bridge between the clarity that an expert witness would bring, yet pain itself sort of being a little ambiguous, coming in and marrying those two together, figuring it all out?
That's a real great question, Jim, and that's exactly the issue that occurs in the legal system, is that pain is a subjective phenomenon. Pain has these fluctuations. It doesn't necessarily follow a logical trail. And so how do we deal with all of this? That is the big question that's out there, and that is a lot of kind of what I'm brought in to do. So in the expert work, it's important to understand whoever retains you as an expert, the counsel that retains you, you need to understand what their goals are in the case, what clarity you need to bring upon reviewing the records that the patient has had for treatment, and then diagnostic testing. And then finally, also there are opinions rendered by other experts, perhaps before you. If these all result in a lack of clarity, you're then it's hard to form an opinion necessarily unless you yourself examine the patient. And that's where at times I see the patient, evaluate the patient after I've evaluated carefully all of the records. They either will have, at the end of the day, a clear diagnosis or not fit a clear-cut diagnosis. The diagnosis we usually see at times thrown around is a nerve pain syndrome called complex regional pain syndrome. This complex regional pain syndrome is a severe pain syndrome that has definite clinical diagnostic criteria as well as exclusion of other medical causes. But you have to be careful and document and put together the necessary elements that are needed to make this diagnosis. All too commonly I see is that people don't know what's going on, simply give a patient this diagnosis, and then that creates a lot of controversy. It also is important to give the patient the right diagnosis so that they themselves know perhaps what they're dealing with and what their prognosis may be and course of treatment. So I think that as with anything else you do, it is imperative to go through all of the facts of the case and put it together. So when you render an opinion, it is based on the facts of the case and the available medical literature that supports your opinions. That's what I enjoy putting together. And this is very, very important. It's important not to just jump into opinions, descriptive words that create controversy, but those descriptive words that render clarity based on the facts of both the medical literature in combination with the facts of the case, both the diagnostic testing, the history, and the examination of the patient.
It's really, I find it very, very fascinating how you have to put all these puzzle pieces together in the way that you do. It brings you great clarity as you're doing it, I'm sure, as well. Do you usually work on cases like malpractice cases, things of that nature?
Yes, there is a component that I do of malpractice cases as well. That unfortunately does come up, and obviously there are medical procedures that are done to treat pain that at times can cause inadvertent injury. That's an important site. Another site might be at times that people incur injury through medications that are used to treat pain. And those are kind of the most common areas that we have in our field where I'm involved in malpractice. But again, that's a component of expert work. Others are involved, as you indicated, personal injury with chronic nerve injury and defining those cases and bringing clarity.
Amazing, really is, when you're thinking about it, all these things that you have to deal with on a regular basis and immerse yourself in. But imagine some expert witnesses are, you know, pretty much just issuing reports, and maybe 99.9% of the time the case sort of settles. But some expert witnesses, I would imagine, also are in court all the time. They're being deposed all the time. They're sort of simplifying the complex information for the jury, right?
Yes, a lot of it is teaching. You're absolutely right to say it that way. Part of that is teaching the counsel that's retained you, teaching the jury that you may have to explain your opinion of the case. A lot of what I've done in my career is teaching and training physicians in pain management. So by having to do that, you have to continue to develop your own ways of explaining complex information, as you stated, and creating those statements that are easy to understand for whether it's physicians, patients, juries. You have to come down to their level in a way that draws them into the case and shows that you clearly understand, therefore you can clearly explain the patient's situation. And I enjoy that, because when I sit and go through the case, I said, do I understand this? That is the key thing. Have I understood both the patient's symptoms and their injuries? And does this make sense in context of the existing scientific medical literature? And then put that all together in a way that's clear, concise, and is easy to read and understand.
Exactly. So, you know, there's so much that goes into, I would imagine, developing the report itself. How does that process begin, and how do you sort of move through it? Tell us about the development of the actual report.
Absolutely. The report is a great deal of work, and it's very, very important work, because it's ultimately going to reflect my signature and opinion I'm going to be held accountable for when I have to defend it in a deposition or in a court in front of a jury. So this is critical work where you know, first thing I do is I'm retained by counsel. I have to understand what counsel expects of me within the report. I then have to specify and review the documents that I use to render my opinion. And you're right, if I have to examine a patient, that also has to be in the report as part of the objective findings that I determined on my clinical examination. Finally, I have to put in the necessary references that I use of the scientific literature informing my opinion. And my opinion has to be within a reasonable degree of medical certainty. In other words, greater than 50% probability that what I'm stating is true and makes sense based on the case facts, my education, training, background, review of the literature. And by putting this together, I have to be ready that this makes great sense, and then I'm able to support it against opposing counsel.
Which is essential, yeah, having the backup info. Yeah, it's very interesting work. You also do independent examinations of the patient. You're not just doing, you know, a chart review. You're actually meeting these people sometimes as well. Tell us about that process.
Absolutely. In a lot of these nerve injury pain syndromes, in particular the one I reference with complex regional pain syndrome, an examination may not be apparently stated in the record. And it becomes unclear to me, do we have the physical examination criteria that appropriately support or refute a certain diagnosis such as complex regional pain syndrome? And it takes a little time to spend with the patient and understand what physical exam findings they have that support this diagnosis. Also get a feel for the degree of impairment they have in using their extremity. This is very important in understanding were the treatments that were given all appropriate, and are there more treatments that should be done before we say that the patient has reached maximum medical improvement. These are all, you know, obviously very important when we're putting together a treatment plan and we're saying, all right, well, we've improved the patient as much as we can, but or no, the patient really doesn't have this diagnosis and they have something else and they should be treated in a different way.
It's very important. Are there cases, any cases that you're allowed to share that stick out in your mind that you can speak about, maybe, of course, not name,
sure,
general ideas?
Sure. You know, one of the hardest aspects of our work when patients who have a significant psychiatric history incur an injury, there is significant magnification of their symptoms from the underlying fragile psychiatric state that may, in a way, not only magnify symptoms of pain and dysfunction, but it also leads to all the destabilization of their psychiatric condition. And when their psychiatric condition, which is so commonly overlooked or not taken into account or not adequately treated or addressed, is not done, the overall chances of actually treating the pain are markedly reduced. And all of my colleagues in the psychological or psychiatric experts or psychological experts in pain are rapidly or quickly to point out that this is a very critical and overlooked area. So I think one of the most important aspects that I do is when I meet patients, I try to get an understanding of how much is their overall thought processes, psychiatric processes contributing to their pain such that we guide them into additional evaluation by psychologists trained in pain medicine that can actually help this component. In other words, restructure their thought processes. If medications are needed to restabilize, say, a depression or anxiety, that this is addressed, and that overall we can start to bring in better coping strategies with chronic pain and reduce these symptoms. You can only imagine that if you have both pain and significant mood disorder, it can lead to substance abuse. And it's so important to get on top of this before we get yet an additional problem such as a substance abuse disorder. trying to medicate both of these problems, that is both the chronic pain as well as depression, anxiety. So more than ever, with as you know and as everybody knows, we have an opioid crisis. It is more imperative than ever to address all of these issues. Granted, as everyone knows, we're also in the emerging from the pandemic, and we know that psychiatric and psychological services are currently under tremendous strain. So these problems are likely to persist and are going to be a challenge for us to treat going forward.
It's been really an amazing couple of years for everybody to sort of adjust and be flexible with and learn from, for sure. Take us through one of the criminal cases. What was it like to be deposed and to actually testify?
Wow, yes. Those are always very memorable cases. You know, as physicians, one of the things we don't know a whole lot about, and I'll be honest, is the aspects of law enforcement that surround or concern opioid prescribing, particularly long-term for chronic pain. As we know, in the 2000s, from 2000 to 2010, there was a lot of freelance or free prescribing of opioids to patients without a whole lot of guidelines, restrictions, and understanding of how to mitigate overprescribing to patients. As a consequence, many clinics emerged, and we know we had the rise of the opioid epidemic. There were, of course, physicians who were very rogue in this process, and practices were closed. Many of them faced charges for prescribing opioids without a legitimate medical purpose and without the usual code of conduct in medicine. That's also being charged to physicians who may have been appropriately prescribing and unfortunately face charges as well as these issues have been addressed across the country. And I found myself defending such physicians who were appropriately prescribing. And the real challenge of where we get into trouble with prescribing is when patients receive opioids for pain management who also may have a history of or develop coexisting substance use disorders. And this is a very contentious area in medicine, and there's no quick formula or easy solution to how to manage patients with substance use disorder, in particular opioid use disorder, who may develop chronic pain. It's not uncommon for people who have substance use disorder to have chronic pain disorders. After all, many of these patients do not live very easy lives and injure themselves in various ways during the course of their lives and incur chronic pain. So the importance here is understanding the nature and intent of physician prescribing of opioids to these patients, understanding the monitoring protocols, and understanding the barriers and limitations set by physicians when trying to treat these patients who are challenging, who are very challenging. And this is, again, the teaching and understanding of the practice of those physicians and their patients they care of. And in conjunction, understanding where the literature lies in explaining how we should treat these patients, and then putting this information together and presenting it to counsel and presenting it to juries in ways that they can understand how challenging it is for clinicians out in the field who are trying to manage these patients.
So important. It's so involved and it's such a delicate balance. What do you love about this challenge, Doctor? It's got to be, every day is something different. Every scenario is something different. Though you have all this expertise and background and know-how, it's still fresh each time you're involved in cases and all of this work, huh?
You're absolutely right. You know, one of the things that's the most interesting when you're doing this is that every physician approaches this a little differently in practice, both in terms of how they prescribe medications, because a lot of it's left to their judgment. Understanding that physicians seem to try to use their best judgment in practice, and the only way you can do this by reviewing the patients they took care of over the clinical years that they took care of these patients. Finally, the policies and protocols that they develop, which is many times unique and again, left to their judgment depending upon the patient population they're treating. And then in parallel, what you have is you have an evolving medical scientific literature that's changing year to year, and is evolving and continues to rapidly evolve. And it's interesting how the pendulum seems to swing with respect to opioid pain medications, where if we go back even 3-4 years ago, it was very, very restrained. But now we're understanding that such abrupt restraints on patients may not actually be helping them and may at times be hurting them. So, you know, we're recognizing that absolutes are probably not the way to go in medicine. We're still trying to find our pathway with opioid pain medications in patients, and in particularly those with coexisting substance use disorders. It's not an easy task for us, but again, I think that what I find is that it's not black and white in any of these cases. But it's important to look at the overall picture of the clinical practice, the overall trajectory of the clinical practice I'm evaluating and defending, and the intent of the physician and the intent of the practice when addressing and trying to treat a pain population.
Exactly. Intent is everything.
Exactly. Intent is everything, and it's not going to be perfect. That is the other thing. I have to be prepared for the fact that, you know, I may not agree with the treatment of every patient. A lot of it's left to judgment. I may not agree with exactly how everything's done. I may not like the documentation of a particular practice, but just because it's not exactly a fit of how I would do things, is it still medical practice? That's what I'm left with judging. And that was new for me, to really understand that this is a medical practice. It may deviate from the best practices in medicine. It may deviate to the level that it's malpractice. But just because a case is malpractice doesn't mean it's a criminal case. It means it might just not be the greatest medicine practice. And that's the important light that I like to bring when I enter the courtroom, is that just because a practice isn't a gold star practice doesn't mean it's not a medical practice. And it is important to look at always the intent, and the intent of the practice was to help the patient and not to prescribe opioids for the sake of getting people addicted to opioids and separating them from, quite frankly, drug dealing.
Right, exactly, which is a whole other, you know, avenue.
Yes.
Sometimes people end up going down. If people want, Dr. Tom, if people want to learn more, should they go to your LinkedIn? Is that the best place to check things out, learn more about your background, your experience?
Yes, yes, absolutely. LinkedIn is great. I'm easily, you can easily do a search on Google. There's plenty of background on me. All across both the organization I worked at, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, continue to work, as well as, like you said, on LinkedIn.
Exactly.
And other sites.
I'll spell the last name. It's SIMOPOULOS for Dr. Thomas. And a real pleasure. This is eye-opening and inspiring and fascinating, the work that you do, and learning more about it. We appreciate your taking time, and I hope we get a chance maybe to explore some more down the line. That would be a real pleasure. And enjoy the Boston Marathon today.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you. Have a great morning, and thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure, and I'm sure we'll chat again soon, Doctor. Keep up the extraordinary work. You're doing work that benefits us all. You take care now, okay?
Thank you very much. You as well. Have a good morning.
You're
bye-bye.
Welcome. You too now. Again, you can go to LinkedIn if you'd like to connect with the doctor. It's a real pleasure having him on the show, and a pleasure having you with us as well. Jim Masters, thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, stay right there. I'll be back just a minute with another great guest on Close Up Radio. Till then, have a great day.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.